Mr. Murray?
Good morning, Justice Steve Moyer. May it please the court, this morning I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. And I plan to address, subject of course, some questions from the court. Primarily the first proposition of law dealing with the status of the record in this case. We believe that this is, in many ways, a case of first impression for the court. While the court has often had situations where there were claims of incomplete or of incorrect records presented to the court, they were generally resolved by either ordering the record or by looking at what the defense counsel or appellate counsel did or did not do in order to attempt under the appropriate rules of this court, appellate rules, to create or complete or correct the record on their own accord. At this point, is our position that we have done everything possible to try to bring a complete record to this court and to try to avoid coming before this court on this appeal, or any court on an appeal, without having a complete record. Unless there's some questions over the facts, having beat that horse to death with some 32 pages, as I see reviewing my brief, I apologize for that. I won't go over the facts again, but I think a brief review of some of the history of this case as it pertains to the record issue.
But the facts are important in this case, are they not?
The facts are important.
I mean, we're really talking about people who, somebody in effect who has admitted that he killed two people, that he got upset with somebody driving. He put, I think, two bullets in the head of one, two bullets in the head of another. And if we're talking about errors in procedure, then we fall back on the rule that the evidence is overwhelming here, and we're back to the question of mitigation. Are you going to argue guilt?
I'm not going to argue guilt with respect to did Mr. Palmer, was he the person with the firearm that shot or that expelled the shots that killed the two victims. We are going to argue issues about what was the process, was the procedure fair in which he presented his defense. He wanted to present a defense of self-defense. He wanted to get an instruction from family and manslaughter. The Court of Appeals used statements that he had made to jailers that were presented at trial in conjunction with the statements that he gave, which you referred to support the finding of the overwhelming evidence for both the conviction and the aggravating circumstances found by the jury. But all of those result from a process that, in our opinion, because of the incomplete record, well, it was unfair, but because of the incomplete record, we can't present everything that we normally would had it all been recorded and preserved. And so that makes this court's job much more difficult, our job much more difficult, if not impossible to do because of the various items that are missing in the record. So to that extent, Justice Douglas, right, facts are important, but we also need to look at was the process fair, and that is just as important, especially in a capital case. Now, briefly, there were 10 items of 10 documents of motions and pleadings that we have filed over the course of years for this case, seeking to complete the record. And we started on June 30th, 1990, with a suggestion of an incomplete record in the trial court. Thereafter, and that was docket number 16, if the court's interested. Thereafter, we filed motions seeking time to supplement the record. We asked that the appeal, the Court of Appeals, be stayed so that we could try to complete the record. We filed a motion to correct and modify the record. We had a conference with the Court of Appeals where we found a lot of documents that were not in the record, that were just in drawers and elsewhere.
I think I'm satisfied that you made good faith efforts, but where I get hung up is what happened that was off record that would prejudice your client because it wasn't preserved. I looked for that issue more because you satisfied me you made good faith efforts. So if you could get right to that issue, what exactly happened off record that is so prejudicial to your client that you should reverse?
Well, there are several things, and because the record is incomplete, we can't know everything that's happened because, as the trial court has said, it's all said in its entry, we can't recreate everything because the recollection doesn't have everything. But I can point to several things, about five or six, that we have good indications in the record that I feel are prejudicial to Mr. Palmer's case. One, the court and the attorneys, the trial counsel, had conversations off the record regarding motions, either filed or anticipated. One of those motions was a motion to suppress the statements made by Donald Palmer to various jailers while he was in the county jail awaiting the trial in this matter. Now, that is addressed in the entry of the judge, the trial court, when he adopted the Greek statement in paragraph 3, and it's 856-57 of the appendix. Now, with that, with those conversations, it was admitted in there that the trial counsel for the defendant, Mr. Nicholson, withdrew that motion to suppress. Now, there was an error in the brief. I said at one point that it was filed on September 8th and it was withdrawn on September 8th. It was actually withdrawn on September 18th, 10 days later.
But if he withdrew the motion, then doesn't that make it moot as to whether there is anything valid? He's withdrawn the motion, so it's no longer pending before the court.
But what he has said and what the agreed statement says is that he withdrew it because the court told him he was not going to rule in his favor. He was not going to suppress anything. That leaves this court with absolutely no way to see what evidence might have been there to support the claims for the suppression. How valid was it? That's why we have Rule 12b for suppressions, because we really want records here for everybody to be able to look at in the light of day, not just speculate that the judge would have been or would not have been right. We have no way of telling because there was no evidence. We also indicate in a proposition of law regarding ineffective assistance that was not something any reasonable counsel in that circumstance would do. The other factors include the...
On that same subject, though, can you go further to find that motion had some prospect of being granted? This particular motion that you find that isn't in the record was the basis for the motion and therefore its potential for being granted? If it wouldn't have been granted anyway.
I don't know that it wouldn't have been granted.
I
have looked at the motion. I think the motion's in the record, but I could be wrong. One of the things I've done here is come over twice looking through the record that was sent out, and I filed two motions saying it's not complete, it's not all here. But the motion that was originally filed on September 8th is in the docket, and I think there's just an entry that it's withdrawn. I don't think it's been removed. And that motion was to suppress the statements made by Donald Palmer to certain jailers because he wasn't Mirandized, and they instigated that he pushed him without knowing what the facts surrounding how that conversation or those statements came about, whether the jailers actually pushed him, whether they, you know, tried to get him to talk or whether he approached them. We don't have a record to be able to tell that. And it could never be decided. So I don't know. I have to assume that the defense counsel had a good faith argument to file a motion. Otherwise, he'd have Rule 11 sanctions or some other problems with the trial court judge. But I don't know what he could have established at hearing the grant.
There'd be
good things
withdrawn
in the debate. Except that he has admitted, and the trial court and the prosecutors have agreed, that it was withdrawn because they had the motions in, or the hearings in the hallway, and the judge says, I'm not going to rule, you might as well withdraw. So I don't think that we can say what he said what it was. It's not a question of whether it was good faith or not. We're not trying to determine or presuming that it was strategy at this point. He's already given a valid reason, and it's been adopted by the trial court. Back to Justice Stratton's questions on the prejudice, the other areas include what I call a runaway bail for the jury view, the use of Exhibit 29, which I never could get in the record, but this court finally managed to do that by asking Belmont County to send it out here, at least one of the guns. The jury instructions, there were objections made, there were requests made for instructions. We have no idea. Every time the state has argued, we have no idea what they were. Every time the state has argued that it should be looked at as plain error because the trial counsel failed to object or seek, request certain instructions, but the Court of Appeals adopted that and said that it was waived, the issues were waived because of that, where in fact there were discussions pursuant to that agreed statement that took place where the objections and requests were made. There's also indications that the defendant was not present on several occasions, including the motion for new trial, several proceedings that happened during the trial. There was a question on the jury view, although in our attempt to complete this record, we recreated that he was in fact present at the jury view. There's also indications that they had discussions with regarding Reverend Bush, a potential mitigation witness who had met with Donald Palmer, and the trial court said, without having any hearing on that, basically, I'm not going to let you present that. He said, you can present it to me. Now, whether that was ever done, I don't know. There's nothing in the record that shows it was done. But if you look at the sentencing TR-7, you can see that there's an indication that they prior discussion about this individual, because all of a sudden, the prosecutor says, well, you should have known for a long time if you're going to call him as a witness. So obviously, they had talked about it before, as they had everything else in this case. Not to use a sexist term, but this trial was in a good old boys type of situation where everything was just done with a nod and wink in the back room firsthand, and the people did not make a complete record of it. And I think we're going to put the blame on somebody. It should fall on everybody, but who it shouldn't fall on is Donald Palmer at this point. As fellow counsel, as we said, we've tried everything we can to get through that. Those are several items that I think where the prejudice is shown. Now, certainly we can't go to a point of saying we're going to have a completely different outcome at this point because of what had happened, because by the agreed statement's own contents that the trial court adopted, there are many items that can't be recreated. There are
many what would be less than a completely different outcome? You can see that you can't even argue that there would have been a so-called completely different outcome.
I can argue that that the outcome that we have is certainly unreliable. And I think that it clearly is. I mean, we have no idea how the jury would have ruled or found, how the Court of Appeals would have ruled, but for the statements, for example, that he made to the jailers. They were used on, like I said, 5 or 6 occasions to support the claims of the trial court that there was overwhelming evidence. They were used throughout the prosecutor's opening and closing arguments to the jury at both the trial phase, when he used it to talk about the intent, and mitigation phase, the sentencing phase, to talk about the relative importance or weight of the aggravating circumstances. So I think with those types of things that you have that, you have a gun that's coming in, we have an unsworn witness testifying as a gun expert, that this is similar to the one, or almost identical to the one that was used in his opinion, but not necessarily in Mr. Palmer's, and that it can fire accidentally.
The results could have been different, you say, as to death or guilt?
Douglas, I think it could have been different as to either. I think at least we can't say that they're reliable as to either, because a lot of this information, for example, the gun itself and the statements made by Donald Palmer to jailers were emphasized over and over by the prosecution and subsequently by the lower court of appeals with respect to intent and also with respect to the instructions on manslaughter and or self-defense and whether they should have been given.
Well, clearly, on several occasions, he admitted that he shot these two people, did he not?
He admitted that he had the gun and that he shot these people, yes. But that doesn't make him necessarily eligible for the death penalty. There's a lot of...
That's why I'm asking you. Now you're talking about penalty. You're not talking about guilt.
Well, I was talking... If he shot the people, it doesn't mean that there's a difference between aggravated murder, the different types of aggravated murders we have, murder, manslaughter, self-defense. So to that extent, I'm talking about guilt. To a large extent, I'm talking about the penalty phase reliable. Yes. Absolutely. Because it affects, if nothing else, the aggravated circumstances, the weighing process itself, the tainted, if you would, by this information and how it came in. And without the proper ability to challenge, for example, his statement that without the proper ability the courts could view such things as a jury instruction, so whether the evidence, like I said, 29 should have been used, whether Reverend Bush should have been allowed to testify as a mitigation witness, all of those are very key items, I think, from the sentencing phase. With respect to the standard that we believe should be imposed here of who has the burden and what are we going to do with respect to this prejudice, we think it's important to look at the history of the court's opinion, starting with Arrington, where the court said, well, if you're not getting a transcript, the state has a burden to show that there either is of no value to you, it's basically not going to be of value to the defendant or appellant, or that there's some other means by which the record can be completed or the case can be reviewed by the court. Now, subsequent to that, court knows you had a series of cases wherein there were items missing from the record, but it wasn't just the state not giving it. It was that they weren't there, they were never recorded, they were incomplete, or no one had them typed up, and no one thought to really ask for it or bring it to the court. And this court has consistently and rightfully maintained that we have Appellate Rule 9, various sections, just for that purpose, and we place a burden on appellate counsel to do that process. And where that process is not completed, where they haven't tried to recreate the record or to otherwise demonstrate some sort of prejudice, that this court isn't going to presume it. Well, now we have a situation where we've done that. We have recreated the record to the best of our ability, although we weren't allowed to have a hearing or we weren't allowed to go back to a new trial. But we do have a situation where we recreate the record. We have come forth with and presented or raised several areas of prejudice. I think at this point the court should go back to the Arrington standard and say, unless the government can now show that there's either some other alternative way to do this, or that it would be of no value for this review, that this court has to take a stand, and I think that it has to take a stand and put it on the state for that. And if not, I think this case should be remanded for a new trial. There's just too many interactions between this proposition law and the other issues we raised. All of the jury instruction issues, the issue about the gun, and all the other ones, the unsworn statement, the unsworn testimony of Sheriff McFord, who was a key witness talking about one of the critical factors was whether that gun actually could be accidentally fired. By my count, there were 25 propositions of law. 14 of them the state claimed waiver. 7 of those deal with jury instructions, 4 with objections, and 3 with requests. Now, we have no way to respond to that because all of the requests and objections and the jury instructions, for example, were done off the record. So that leaves us in this court in a very precarious position. I think the case is too important to sit back and allow it to proceed without a full and complete record as is the situation here. I think that sort of shift of the burden to the state at this point is also appropriate because the federal court will effectively place that burden on the state under the rules governing 2254 cases, the habeas cases, and these capital cases, which are kind of many. The state has the burden. It is statutorily given the burden of presenting the entire record sufficient to deal with all of the issues raised by the defense and its agents. If this court doesn't make them present that now, and I think the only way we can do that is send it back to the new trial, then we're going to be in federal court raising these issues, and the federal court's going to be asking why isn't this record complete.
Whose responsibility was it to see that these matters were on the record?
Well, I think it's a joint responsibility. I think the first spot, the defense counsel has a responsibility to make sure that there's a complete record, obviously. And that's the primary reason we raise the ineffective assistance claim. We've also tried to raise that and the lack of record in the post-conviction. As we know now, we had a statute of limitations on post-conviction. My co-counsel, who couldn't be here, handled the post-conviction, and that has already been dismissed, so we've got no other way to create the record. I think it's also the duty of the court to make sure that there is a full record. Criminal Rule 22 and Appellate Rule 9 together say, in all capital cases and all these serious cases, we want a complete record. This court wants it. This court deserves it. Everybody down there is on notice. I think the prosecutor shares that burden of duty, the defense counsel shares that burden of duty, and the court shares that burden of duty.
So everybody's at fault.
Everybody, absolutely. But the one who's not is Donald Palmer. He doesn't have control over the record. He's not even always there in this case. If there are no other questions, I will stop and proceed with the rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Ms. Anderson.
My name is Joyce Anderson, and today I'm representing the Belmont County Prosecutor's Office. Before I begin, I'd like to make one thing clear, and that is that although the state did rely upon waiver in its brief where it was appropriate, the state's position is that there were no errors committed.
What is your response to Mr. Murray's contention that this case gets to habeas in a federal court? The federal court is going to require that there be a complete record here, despite the fact that the allegation is, or the contention is, that the silence in the record is not prejudicial to the defendant.
The federal courts require the state to provide the record. I've never read a federal court case that requires the state to provide a record that isn't there. And so I suppose my answer would be I disagree with him entirely, that the federal court that I know of has never required the state to provide a record that isn't there. We would also point out that...
Does that mean that if there were important parts of the transcript that were not a part of the record, that just weren't, that weren't there, that the federal court wouldn't require it?
I agree that if there were, that there are cases, federal cases, where... for example, the entire transcript has been lost because the court reporter's notes have burned in a fire. I think there was one case where the entire, I don't remember exactly, but it's huge portions of the transcript. When there are huge portions of the transcript that used to be available but aren't anymore, then yes, they have on occasion sent it back and said, on some occasions, even when there's no transcript at all, sent it back and said that the defendant got a new trial. That's not what we're dealing with here.
Don't we have to first determine whether the defendant has been prejudiced by the absence of this record, and if he's been prejudiced, then it would be reversible error?
Absolutely, you have to first determine if there's been prejudice. If there were prejudice, and if you find that the defendant had established prejudice, then yes, I would agree it's reversible error, although I can't imagine how
well,
you find that.
But isn't that the heart of this particular issue, the absence of record, of the record concerning these matters?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the last part. Yes, I'm agreeing with you that prejudice is crucial.
Isn't that part of your argument that the absence of the record over these matters did not prejudice the defendant? I don't understand why you're having difficulty with my question.
I think I've already answered it. Yes, I agree that if there were prejudice...
Well, you sounded a little confused.
I'm sorry?
I said you sounded a little bit confused over it, and I thought it was a simple question.
Perhaps the reason I'm confused was because I thought I had answered it already, and then you were asking something different. I couldn't figure out what it was that was different that you were asking. Yes, if there is prejudice shown, then yes, I would agree it is reversible error.
Okay, having straightened out the confusion, let's go to the other part of that issue that Justice Resnick raises, and that is, aren't these mostly just unrecorded bench conferences?
Correct.
And hasn't the Sixth Circuit very clearly in the Gallo case rejected the presumption of prejudice from unreported bench conferences.
The Fifth Circuit that I'm aware of, I'm not familiar with the exact case that you cite, but they have rejected a presumption of prejudice in all cases on the little lapses, if you will.
But we're dealing with unrecorded bench conferences here.
Well, unrecorded bench conferences and the agreed statement of fact also refers to some conversations, which I'm not even sure are as part of the trial. One conversation that Mr. Murray was talking about regarding the motion to suppress was between the defense attorney and the trial court. At some point, they couldn't remember. The prosecutor wasn't there. Apparently, it was out in the hallway somewhere. And I'm not even sure that's part of the trial. And what the prosecution did not stipulate that that's what happened because they weren't present. That what the stipulation was, and it's on page 5 of the agreed statement of facts, is that parties interviewed, to which the defense attorney and the court, could not remember, but it is recorded that the trial court made statements to defense counsel to the effect that the court determined that no evidence should be suppressed. And then it goes on to say, the court, in addition to the court not being impressed with the motion suppressed, the court also indicated that it would hear the motion if it had to, but that there was no need to do so. Mr. Murray claims that this court can't tell whether that motion would have been granted or not. On the contrary, this court can read the transcript and affirmatively conclude that that motion would have been denied. The deputies who testified that they were sitting outside the cell where the defendant was being held. One was reading a book, and that the defendant was talking a blue streak to whoever would listen. One deputy even said, I tried to ignore him for a while and read my book, but finally I couldn't ignore him anymore, so I closed the book and listened to what he had to say. Another deputy had said that he had been instructed not to ask him any questions, and therefore he did not. He just sat there. And the defendant confessed essentially to anyone who would listen. And therefore, the state's position would be that it is affirmatively shown on the record that the motion to suppress would have been overruled. And that is the only prejudice that I heard Mr. Murray mention. He said he had five things, and I wrote down one, and I didn't hear any more. Many of the bench conferences and various conversations that are covered in the agreed statement of facts affirmatively show that there was no prejudice. They had to do with various things like who goes first with this or that, and who does the sort of administrative things that all trials involve. Regarding the gun and the similarity and the fact that it was a model, the defendant himself testified at trial that the gun was similar to the one that he used. And he agreed that the trigger pull was the same and that the gun had to be cocked to fire, and that was similar to the gun that he had used and that he then said he threw in the Hoover Dam. I don't remember whether that was a testimony or in one of his statements, but he threw the gun at me in Hoover Dam. He said they looked for it and never found it. Moreover, even if the court accepts the defendant's version of the facts, which the Court of Appeals, in its opinion below, seemed to accept the defendant's version that the gun went off by accident. It didn't really come right out and say, we believe that. It said, this is what the defendant said, and didn't really say, we reject this or that. But even if the court accepts that, that still leaves the defendant unable to explain the next three bullets. And therefore, even if the court were to accept everything the defendant said about the gun and then how it came about, it would still establish both the prior calculation and design murder and the felony murder because he then walked over to these people and shot them in the head twice.
It doesn't have anything to do with guilt or innocence, but I guess when I read this, I was just curious as this is our first case of what we're hearing a lot about now, road rage. Is this a case of road rage?
Well, Your Honor, the state's position was that it was not. the defendant's position was that it was. The state's position was that the defendants were, in fact, looking for someone to rob. And that's where the evidence comes in about the convenience store that they went to twice in 30 minutes and looked around and made people suspicious enough to write down their license plate number. The person that they followed home and then went on but made the person suspicious enough to call someone about it. It was the state's position at trial that this was prior cancellation and design from long before their encounter with Mr. Spotholz. It was the defendant's position that it was a case of road rage when Mr. Hill ran into Mr. Spotholz's truck, that Mr. Spotholz got out and engaged in some road rage. But I agree with you, it has nothing to do with guilt or innocence because you still have three bullets that are unexplained.
Well, the reason I ask that question is because we're almost getting to the point where road rage seems to be argued as a defense to this sort of thing. Road rage, if this is a case of road rage, it's not a good defense, is it?
No, certainly not. And that is what he was trying to argue, that he was raising road rage as a defense, although that term was not in vogue when this was tried in 1989. But certainly it is not a good defense. And even if it were, we still have three bullets after that fired into the heads of each of these two men. So even if you accept everything the defendant says, he's still guilty. And regarding the mitigation evidence, it was so meager that the death penalty would be supported, even if you believe what the defense says. If the court has no further questions, I believe I've covered everything that we would like to say. Thank you. The state would ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
Is your best position on Reverend Bush's testimony waiver?
Best position, but it's fairly clear to me that it wouldn't have been admissible anyway, since although he was given the chance to proffer and did not, I'm reading too much into the transcript, but what I got from the transcript was that he was going to testify that the death penalty was a bad idea, or that he didn't think this defendant deserved the death penalty, and either one of those are inadmissible. But the best position is certainly waiver because he failed to proffer what the witness would say.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Murray, you saved 9 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't need it all unless you must stand here. With respect to Justice Douglas' question on Reverend Bush, one of the problems we have is exemplified by the question, because at one point the prosecution indicated that their position was that he was only going to talk about the death penalty, whether it was good or valid under his religious tenets. But if you look at the transcripts where this was discussed, especially the sentencing transcripts at the beginning for 10 pages or so, that's where it's clear that they talked about assessment. And it's clear that they're talking about the defense position, was they're talking about somebody who had met with Mr. Palmer sometime during.
Let's assume he was going to talk about the death penalty. Is that per se inadmissible?
Well,
in mitigation?
There have been cases around the country that go those ways, and my opinion is that cases in the state of Ohio would say that is not a relevant issue. Although in this case we have another factor, and that is that there is a propositional law 17, which was never addressed by the Court of Appeals, talked about the prosecutorial misconduct for seeking support through death penalty from the Bible. Doing all the voir dire questioning within another propositional law, which relates to these. And you've got them pushing that position. I think the trial counsel made an argument at the point that it would be very relevant to counteract what the state's position was from voir dire on with respect to religious tenets regarding the death penalty. The other thing that was mentioned during the state's argument here was that, and during my argument, the question seemed to, and I've done this long enough to know that you can't always go by the question from the court, but they seemed to focus in many ways on one thing: how important were these gaps in the record? Are they that serious? Our position is that it certainly are, and with all due respect, just to tell this, this isn't mostly about unrecorded bench conferences. There were eight bench conferences unrecorded, set forth in the agreed statement. Two of them were resolved, two of them were partially recreated, four of them remain that we could not recreate them. And then we have the other off-record issues, including a juror being excused somewhere, was not being on the record, don't know where, but we know he's off. The motion to suppress and the other motions that we talked about. The reference to Brady information, Mr. Gooley, there were conversations about that that were never put on the record. We have a runaway bailiff from the jury, you're refusing to let him go back to the court. One of the defense saying, you're showing scenes and views that were not authorized, we want to go back to the court and get a ruling, he wouldn't do it. We got the Reverend Bush stuff, both mitigation and whether one of the jurors was at his sermon during the trial. We have the firearm argument objection. We have the prosecutor's visual aid, which the trial court refused to preserve for appellate review. It's never going to be before you because they've gotten rid of it. We've got defendant's absence at many key times in the trial. We got the objections and requests for jury instructions. I mean, there are many more things than just the unrecorded bench conferences. If that was all it was, then I'd say we'd be in the water. All the work would have been fruitless, but I don't think that's where we're at. I just think that we go back to the fact that this is a constitutional issue, as this court said in State Actual Circo. It's just a book. We cannot countenance a situation where a person engaged in the contest of the state for his life should be placed in the untenable position of having to present his case before an appellate court without a comprehensive record to assist him. That's what the problem is going to have to do and has been for the last 7 years. We certainly think that it's unfair, and we ask that the court reverse and remand this case for a new trial and the alternatives. If you think that only the issues are only that apply only to the sentencing are the only ones that deserve relief, then reverse for at least a new sentencing hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.